So in this podcast, we're going to be talking about a dynamic systems approach to modal learning. So unlike the cognitive systems approach, which views modal learning as an organized process or step by step or linear, the dynamic systems approach views modal learning as a much more complex and unpredictable and constantly changing process. The basic idea behind the dynamic systems approach is that the body is a complex system made up of millions of different parts. All these parts are constantly interacting with each other and the outside world. So, unlike the cognitive systems approach, the dynamic systems approach does not suggest that our movements are coordinated exclusively by a single centralized command center. Instead, it suggests that our movements are coordinated and controlled through complex, non-linear interactions between all parts of the body. The dynamic systems approach suggests that motor skills are learnt and carried out dynamically in response to certain variables, and we call these variables constraints. There's three types of constraints that are central to the dynamic systems approach. So these include task constraints. Task constraints are the aspects of the task that need to be overcome or adapted to. So these include rules of the game, shape and weight of equipment, size and shape of the playing surface, etc. You also have your environmental constraints. So these are changeable aspects of the environment that need to be overcome or adapted to, such as weather, the condition of the playing surface, or even the number of spectators. Finally, we have individual constraints. So these are characteristics of the actual individual themselves that they need to overcome or need to be overcome or adapted to. So these include things such as height, weight, skill, strength, motivation, and even confidence. With the dynamic system approach, we also have what we call self-organization. And your self-organization is a key concept of this approach. And what it refers to are the many adjustments that the learner is constantly making in response to the constraints that have been placed on them. So, without any conscious thought or specific instructions from a coach or a teacher, the human body always strives to maintain equilibrium right down to that cellular level. And when the body self-organizes, it's trying to establish a movement pattern that is able, or that is stable and balanced. The dynamic systems approach suggests that all the parts of the body work together to achieve this stability, as opposed to just the brain and the central nervous system controlling the body, which is the cognitive systems approach. Once a person becomes stable, they become comfortable and then can produce a motor skill easily and reliably. When it comes to sport and physical activity, the dynamic systems approach suggests that with a favorable environment and a suitable task to perform, an individual will spontaneously produce effective and efficient movement sequences. It also suggests that the body will develop efficient movement patterns based on the constraints that it faces. So, according to the dynamic systems approach, your teachers and coaches still have an important role to play as facilitators, helping learners in the acquisition of skills. So, by manipulating the task and the environmental constraints, the teachers and coaches can encourage learners to solve movement problems through the exploration of different movement sequences. So, as we spoke earlier, by the instructors or the teachers manipulating the environment by adding the constraints, that enables the athlete to learn the correct technique subconsciously by performing that task. So they're not there standing there thinking, okay, well, what's the step-by-step process that I need to do to complete this task? based on that environment that has been set, their body is subconsciously learning those movement sequences so that when they occur in a game setting, their body knows exactly what to do. In our next podcast, we're going to talk more about constraints and what they actually are and break down those three types of constraints. So in this podcast, we're going to be looking at the different types of practice that we use. So by the end of this, you're going to be able to define and distinguish between all those different types of practice. And then you'll also be able to identify examples of these concepts in regards to swimming. So first of all, let's look at practice. Now, practice is an essential part of learning and refining our motor skills. It's also one of the main ways to develop the five characteristics of motor skill learning. So if you remember, we had stability, persistence, improvement, consistency, and adaptability. And practice helps us to improve those. Through practice, the development of these characters will increase a player's confidence and also their ability to make better decisions when they're under pressure and in game or real settings. However, the practice will only assist the player when the type of practice that they use is relevant to their particular stage of learning. So if we look at, for example, learners who are in the cognitive stage, the beginners, they generally need to practice in a closed environment to make their skills more fluent and consistent. Whereas learners at the autonomous stage generally need to practice in a range of different environments to develop the consistency required in those stressful real life situations. Practice is classified into a few different types, and those are massed practice and distributed practice, whole practice and part practice, blocked practice, serial practice and random practice, constant practice and varied practice, drills and problem solving, and specificity and variability practice. So firstly, we're going to have a look at massed practice and distributed practice. So massed practice is when a skill is practiced in a continuous, constant manner, and rest periods are either very short or non-existent. An example, a real simple example of massed practice is a basketball shooter practicing their shooting continuously for 20 minutes. Successful massed practice requires correct technique, high levels of concentration, and sufficient fitness to minimize fatigue affecting the performance. And for those reasons, massed practice is more suited to skilled or highly skilled performers. If we look at then distributed practice, that's when a skill is practiced with periods of rest that are equal to or longer than the periods spent training. So again, for example, using a basketball shooting practice, they practice shots from the right side of the net for 5 minutes. Then they have a break for 5 minutes, and then they repeat that process on the other side of the net, for example, with another 5 minutes of shooting. So both massed practice and distributed practice are effective when learning basic skills. However, to improve your performance, distributed practice is more effective than massed practice because it allows time for that feedback, and then it decreases the risk that the learner becomes tired and loses concentration. Distributed practice is also more effective when the energy demands of the skill are high, when the skill being learnt is complex, and when the learner's motivation is also low. Next, we'll look at whole practice and part practice. The whole practice is when a skill is practiced as a whole, so in its entirety. And part practice is when a skill is practiced in its separate parts. So for example, if we look at a golf swing, it can be taught in its entirety, so a whole swing, or we can break that swing up into its components. For example, the grip, the stance, the takeaway, downswing, impact of the ball, and also follow through. When choosing between whole and part practice, coaches need to consider which stage of learning the individual is at and the complexity of the skill. Although part practice can make a skill simpler, coaches need to be cautious not to change the nature of the skill. For this reason, when determining parts of the skill, they should be the largest component a learner can handle. That is, as many small parts as possible after each other. This will aid in developing the timing and rhythm required to perform the skill as a whole. Next, let's look at blocked, serial, and random practice. So blocked practice is when the learners repeat an isolated skill for a period of time or number of repetitions. For example, blocked practice in volleyball might consist of 50 digs, 50 sets, and 50 serves. This is a traditional approach, and the intention is to correct errors and also refine motor skills. Learners in the cognitive stage can gain more confidence from blocked practice, but their ability to retain and adapt these skills does not necessarily carry through to the game situations and in an open environment. Serial practice is when a set of skills is performed in a set sequence. So for example, practicing a set of six touches in touch football. So what this is doing is replicating the skill typical to an authentic game situation. However, it lacks the unpredictability found in a competitive or an authentic environment. We've also then got random practice, and that's when several different sets of skill are practiced in an order that is constantly changing. In volleyball, for example, random practice would involve a learner switching between performing digs, sets, and spikes from different positions on the court. During that random practice, the learner does not practice any one particular skill for a length of time, but changes from one skill to another until a certain time or a number of repetitions has been achieved. And what that does is when you switch from one skill to another, it develops stronger neural pathways, and this increases the chance that the learner will remember and produce that skill in a competitive environment. And random practice is better suited to athletes that are at the associative or at the autonomous stages of learning. So we then have constant practice and varied practice. And constant practice is when a skill is practiced under the same conditions. An example, if we look at softball, is throwing a ball to a partner who is 10 meters away for a specific period of time or a specific number of repetitions. And what this does, it is essentially reinforces the motor skill for one specific condition. Your varied practice is when variations of a particular skill are practiced in no particular order. For example, throwing a softball over specific distances. So we might change it, as we spoke before, if it was 10 meters, we might have a target of 20 meters, and then 30 meters, and then back to 10 meters. Both of these, so your constant and your varied practice, have their advantages. However, your varied practice actually can replicate competitive conditions more accurately. And it's rare to get an opportunity to replay the same skill in an authentic game situation. So, for example, looking at golf, you may only get one chance to hit the chip shot of 50 meters that round. And when throwing a softball from the outfield, the distance to the target is going to change every time. We've got specificity and variability practice. So your specificity practice is when skills are practiced in an environment that is as close to match conditions as possible. The drills developed for specificity practice need to be realistic, and they also need to include the specific skills that would be used in an actual match situation. So, for example, let's look at tennis. On match day, they'll not only have to hit balls, but they'll have to run around the court as well. Specificity practice that has the player altering between hitting and running sprints on the court is a good way to replicate the degree of fatigue that they'll probably experience on that match day. Likewise, if a cricketer is playing their games on a turf wicket, then they should practice on that exact surface. Your variability practice is when your practice sessions incorporate a variety of movement options and context changes. And then, so due to the increase in skill complexity in these types of exercises, those neural pathways, which are remembering the skills, they're getting strengthened and helping you understand and learn these skills better. And as a result, that's stronger motor program development. The skill can be made more complex and unpredictable by making changes to the movement, the equipment, or the environment. So movement modifications might see the players practice shooting a goal while standing on one leg, or maybe catching a ball while standing on a wobble board. Equipment modifications are used to increase unpredictability, and such as we could practice a racket sport with fewer strings in the racket, or maybe using a weighted touch football to improve your passing strength with that heavier ball. Then your changes to the environmental conditions could include running on sand or unfamiliar terrain, or even something like if you're practicing golf in the rain. Lastly, we have our drills and our problem-solving drills. So as you know, drills are a common method that we use for developing our skills. And the traditional model for drills is to repeat an isolated individual skill or a small set of skills in a relatively closed or a simple environment. And what that does is it reinforces the motor program and can be recalled from a player's bank of skills as required in various environments. So, for example, if we look at a cricket drill, batting in the nets against a bowling machine to practice your front foot drives. Reproducing that same movement that you have been drilling in an actual match condition can be positive, or it can also be negative. Your problem-solving drills can be used to help practice reading a situation based on environmental cues and respond to those cues in the most suitable way. So a player who can do this has greater potential to produce successful performances because it is concerned with adapting to that environment. And that, as you may remember, reflects on the dynamic systems approach. Our games and sports often have tactical problems that the players need to solve to increase their successful outcomes, such as how can they create space in an invasive game to increase the chance of passing to your teammate, or how to isolate a player to create a scoring opportunity. So the advantage of problem-solving drills are that they can be modified to suit the level of the learner. And when developing moving into space strategies, a larger grid with less players, for example, can be used for learners at the cognitive stage. The same drill could also be used for associative and autonomous learners by decreasing the size of the playing grid or even increasing the number of players. And modifications like these to drills then have to prompt problem solving. And that could include problem solving about the skills used, problem solving about the size of the field, problem solving about the scoring zones, the method of scoring, or even the team composition. So, for example, reducing or increasing the number of defenders or attackers in basketball practice. So you can see that there's quite a few different types of practice. And as we discussed at the start, practice is an essential part of learning and refining our motor skills. Okay, so you've got to suggest, or you've got to find the different type of practice when you are practicing that is best suited for, one, the skill that you want to be practicing, two, the environment, or three, even the level of learner that you are. Because as we also discussed, if you're using a type of skill that is too complex for you, who may be in the cognitive stage, then that practice is going to be likely unsuccessful. So remember, when choosing your type of practice for your swimming assignment task, make sure that you're using something that is going to be representative of your stage of learning and that is going to maximize your development of a motor program at its best.